Well, there are, I don't know what the exact number, 13,000 or 14,000 or 12,828 or something public companies, and I'm sure that that there is a variance among them. But and that again is a reason for not specifying an exact rule. I'm sure that you're going to have some variety in how this something like this would be applied. Now, that's the best I can answer.
Thanks, Linda Griggs.
I just want to commend the PCAOB for this document. I think it's very thought-provoking. I think it tees up a lot of the issues that audit committees and auditors need to be thinking about in this two-way communication. I do think that I come from sort of the bias that a principles-based standard might be more effective in requiring the auditors to exercise judgment in developing this communication tool. And I wonder whether, rather than a list of required items to discuss, a standard that sets forth recommended areas to consider, and perhaps there you could put tone at the top in this list of recommended areas, because I agree with Denny and Mike, but I also acknowledge that the quality of auditors and the quality of audit committees differs across the nation. And so providing this list of items for the auditors to think about would be very helpful. It might not be something that an auditor would think about, that he should be talking about the tone at the top, and you might have an audit committee that hadn't really thought of that. And so I think teeing it up as an issue but without making it a requirement might address some of Mike and Denny's concerns about the need for an infrastructure to identify. Because as a lawyer, I understand you want some precision, you want to know what the requirement is, if it in fact is a requirement. But if it's simply a list of areas that should be considered by the auditors in talking to the audit committee, perhaps you get away from that. The other thing is you really want to empower and make the auditors realize their responsibility to exercise judgment. They've got to figure out what the audit committee needs to know. The audit committee doesn't need to know what's in the financial statements. The audit committee doesn't need to know things that have been already communicated by management. But the audit committee does need to know what areas of risk were important enough to the auditors to develop their plan, their audit plan. They need to know what the auditors found when they completed their audit. And, you know, sometimes they don't find anything bad, so there's no reason to have a presentation on that. The other thing I feel strongly about is, having been on an audit committee, I did find the written materials enormously helpful. And I don't think the auditor should be going through all the written materials. I think the auditors should then be required to talk about the important areas. But having a list, I mean, for a non-accountant on an audit committee, it was useful to me to have some of the information that, you know, they had, through their eyes, they teed up for me. So I think there's a balancing as to what is presented orally and what is presented in writing that helps the audit committee in doing their job. Thanks.
Thank you. Jim Cox.
As I was reading the proposed statement, I was struck by a sort of a historical observation that it was drafted roughly about 2 months before Dodd-Frank was enacted, which, as we know, one of the many provisions in that act carves out the non-accelerated filers from the attest function of 404. And it does raise in my mind whether this document would have somewhat different content on drift had it been written, you know, with that knowledge that was going to happen. Now, we know that the non-accelerated filers were not already subject to 404. They were only threatened to be, and they keep getting prolonged and prolonged. And so a question that would come to my mind, and has come to my mind on the audit committees I serve, is, and I look rather foolishly when I ask this, because for the following reasons, because the answer was that we do comply even though we're not required to. And that is to say, what have you done, auditors, to evaluate the internal controls of this organization that are different from what you do if you were performing in a test function? And what are the risks associated with the distance there about what you would have done if you were testing and otherwise? When I asked this question, two of the three audit committees I serve on are related to Duke University, which complies fully, even though it's not required to, with all the requirements, both listing requirements for the New York Stock Exchange and all the requirements for Sarbanes-Oxley. And so they do have the attest function of our management on the internal controls. So, you know, I think something has to be looked at here in terms that evaluating internal controls, because that is the sine qua non for the auditor's attest function for the financial statements themselves. So I just commend that to think about going forward.
Thank you. Roger Coffin?
Thank you, Marty. Good morning. I just wanted to go back a little bit to the concept that we spoke about regarding check the box and the nature of the communications between the audit committee and the auditors becoming too process-oriented. I think it's helpful to remember that the audit committee, as part of the board, historically has an oversight role. And in fact, you know, the board of directors is really designed to act as a fiduciary on behalf of shareholder interests and to oversee management. And then through Sarbanes-Oxley, the direct link between the board through the audit committee and the auditor was established. And that really, when you think about it, forms kind of the fundamental basis, I think, of modern contemporary corporate governance theory, which is to say an independent board, properly incented, subject to open and fair elections, is one of the best methods to protect shareholder interests. And I think the PCAOB in this standard is really driving towards the independence and the informed part of the board aspect. And I commend you for that. And I largely endorse most of the communications and agree with everything has been said around the table. I would like, though, to just amplify a little bit about the board's fiduciary role here and how that fits into this mix. And I've described this in more detail in a comment letter that I submitted to the public file. Remember that boards as fiduciaries have state law requirements to act in that way. The law that applies to most of the public companies in this country is the law of Delaware. Its enabling statute has a section at section 141 that said the business and affairs of a corporation shall be managed by or at the direction of a board of directors. And what that means and what the courts have done with that statute over the past 80 years is to amplify that and require boards and audit committees to have broad discretion to exercise fiduciary decisions in a flexible manner. As a matter of fact, there was a very significant case in 2008, the case of Computer Associates versus AFSCME, in which the Delaware court actually struck down a shareholder-initiated bylaw that would have purported to have infringed on the jurisdiction of a board to make its own determination. And so from this takeaway, what we see is that under state laws, that boards of directors must be free during their term to be flexible. And not even the shareholder owners can do things to influence or change that. So I guess I would like to caution. That was not what I would like to caution against, although that was a wake-up call. And certainly my comments here are not intended to be that. But to go forward to this, to place this in the context of state fiduciary requirements of boards and to allow the boards of directors to be able to do what they're doing. Remember, if you sometimes check the boxes, as it was said, I think, by Lynn Turner, most good boards are going to ask for a lot of these things. What I think we've seen, and I think what was seen in Enron, was check the boxes actually protect bad boards. In other words, they give bad boards of directors something to hide behind and to allow them to look like they're discharging their fiduciary duties. So while I broadly endorse what's the nature of here, I think I think all of the communications that we describe are valid, and I think you'd want to know, particularly relating to risk. I think the longer the document gets in terms of listing out the number of required communications, the more danger you run towards going down the scale of making it too much of a process. And I think the PCAOB really just needs to be cognizant of where along that scale you'd like to fall.
Roger, thanks for those comments and for the loud burst in between as well that got our attention. In case anybody wasn't listening carefully, we suddenly did. Bob Kippers.
Thanks, Marty. I wanted to pick up on, starting with Mike Cook's comments. I think Linda took it a step further. It suggests then that maybe what we do need to do, or the board should think about, is something that is more principle-based, perhaps with no more than a handful of absolute musts that should be communicated, things like significant disagreements with management, material written communications with management, uncorrected misstatements, and the one that's actually not in the proposed standard, which I think would be important, is related party matters. Related party matters have a particular risk to them that I think should require discussion. Beyond that, I think the circumstances will dictate what else needs to happen. On the one hand, the board is trying to prescribe things auditors must do, yet in this area, you get quickly into the effectiveness of how the audit committee functions, the relationship with the audit committee and management, the audit committee and the auditor, and the auditors and management. But the board only has really authority to deal with one corner of that triangle, and I respect that, and I don't know what the solution is, but it seems to me that, and I have the pleasure of working directly with the audit committees of companies like General Motors, Dow Chemical, and Best Buy, all of them work quite well with all parties. But, you know, trying to look at it through this single lens, I think, puts you in a very difficult place to come up with a comprehensive, effective standard, and perhaps something principles-based with a handful of requirements, plus what the auditor's responsibilities are if something doesn't get done or doesn't work, would serve the same purpose as the standard that you've already proposed.
Thanks, Bob. Karen Hastie-Williams.
Thank you. I wanted to just focus for a minute on the relationship between the audit committee of the board and the auditors. My practice as an audit committee chair has been to meet with the outside auditor, the inside auditor, and the CFO before every board meeting and go over the agenda and raise issues that I think would be relevant for the board. I found that to be very effective in terms of bringing out any kinds of problems or disagreement between the internal auditor and the external auditor, and they have occurred. And it's, from my perspective, it's something that should be taken care of or should be addressed when we have our pre-meeting, so that when we go into the full meeting with the board, we're prepared to state what the issue is and what the proposed resolution is. So I think communication is really key, as I think a number of our colleagues have suggested, in terms of addressing the relationships between the outside, the inside auditors, as well as the CFO.
Would you see any changes to the proposal that we're making as a result of that view that you're expressing?
No, I don't think you need to make changes to the proposal. I think the proposal is fine the way it is, but I think there should be an understanding as this goes forward that there is an important dialogue. It's not just simply that the outside auditor is coming in and here's what we see, but there is a dialogue between the key folks on the financial side in the company as well as with the outside auditors.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Larry Salva.
Thanks, Marty. I agree with a lot of the comments that have been made around the table, probably most so with Bob Kippers in terms of not tying too much the hands of the auditors in terms of being prescriptive on what needs to be communicated. Because I start with the premise that that Mike and Denny started with earlier, and because I view it the same way, is that I'm the asserter of the information. As management, there are financial statements. I take responsibility for the fair presentation, that they are free of material misstatement, and I'm making that assertion in my management report. I then rely on my internal audit function as part of my system of internal control to give me that assurance that I can make that assertion. I also rely on the external auditors to give me assurance, as well as to provide that independent and objective so-called stamp of approval, and we've talked about this at prior SAG meetings, you know, about could the auditor report be improved in terms of communication, because right now it's a pass-fail test. And it seems like there is a desire on the part of some to get more knowledge about what goes into that decision about the pass-fail test. And right now, a lot of that resides with communications to the audit committee and not directly to the shareholders or to the readers of the financial statements about the tough decisions that might have been made along the way as to whether they, the auditors decide to give a pass. I think that in addition to the that assurance or that stamp of approval that comes from the auditors, that investors get a source of information in terms of where to deploy their capital by observing and determining in their minds the openness and the transparency with which management communicates to investors. And that's not just through the financial statements. It's through their earnings press releases, through their dealings with analysts on the analyst call and in analyst meetings. So I believe companies get reputations about how transparent and useful their information is. So that's another source. So it's, as I tend to agree most with Denny, that the primary line of defense for the audit committee or the shareholders is the quality of management and the management reporting. It's then the internal audit function and then the auditors. So placing it into that context, then what's most important? It's tone at the top. It's absolutely tone at the top and throughout the organization as to whether the organization gets it, that their responsibility, you know, is they are fiduciaries of shareholder money, and that it's not their money to be used as they see fit. It's they have a responsibility to the owners of the business. That tone at the top, just to get back to that point of, it's so important as a communication, but it's a difficult one, and certainly I think would hamper the communication if it were required to be put in writing. I'm not present in the audit committee meeting when that is discussed. That is in an executive session, and I would expect it should be there, and to require it in writing basically defeats that purpose. I don't see minutes of what is discussed in the executive session. It's occasionally, when appropriate, I am informed of what has occurred in the executive session. But one way to address that factor might be to consider a required communication from the auditor as to how tone at the top affected their risk assessment in performing their audit, whether it was considered to be a positive factor, a negative factor, or a neutral factor. Because, at least from my experience in public accounting, auditors will attempt to complete a quality audit even when the tone at the top is not the greatest. And it enhances risk assessment when it's there, but, you know, and when it's really bad, typically the decision is that you release that client from your client portfolio. Or, you know, if the board doesn't deal with it appropriately in terms of changing the tone at the top. So it's a factor. It's probably one of the most important factors, I think, in giving the audit committee their sense of whether they're dealing with good people, at least in terms of having an oversight role from external auditors and the audit committee itself.
Thanks, Larry. Just a couple of comments and maybe one question. For the benefit, Larry made a point about the importance of communications by the auditor to investors as well, and some comments that the current audit report, which is binary pass-fail, may not be doing that. Larry has the benefit of being on our SAG as well, that where we've discussed this, and we've indicated that we are taking on a project in the Office of the Chief Auditor to explore changes to the auditor's report in that regard. So I wanted to share that with others here because of the importance of the point you made. But one other thing I'd like to follow up in the context that you're agreeing with Bob Kippers, which is an interesting point by itself that I'd like to follow up. But I thought Hal Schroeder made an interesting point before, and a number of comments have been made about the requirements could just be principles-based and you don't need a checklist. But Hal had made the point that, gee, we have a very talented group of auditors around this table and a very experienced group of audit committee members, and we feel comfortable that we could go with a principles-based standard, and that all of the other auditors who are not sitting at this table, who may not be part of larger organizations, and audit committee members who may sit on just one audit committee and not have as much experience, wouldn't they benefit from the more detailed requirements in here? And I think that was kind of your point, Hal, wasn't it, earlier?
Yeah, yes, it was the beginning of a comment, and I can fill in a couple more points around that. Yep.
Okay. Well, I don't know if you wanted to comment on that now, or we'll let that thought go, but I know there is that point that was brought out that I think is an interesting one for us to continue to explore here.
Yeah, I had more of a question along that front, and I was reminded of a senior partner at the firm I worked for years ago. He said, you know, we talked about our internal audit approach, and he said, well, you know, we don't write these audit approaches for the 10% of us who really know how to do an audit. We don't even need all this written stuff. It's for the 90% of the people that we're trying to bring along. And that comment came back to mind as I listened to everyone's comments around here. We're trying to write a set of rules for the person who has the least amount of knowledge. And I'm wondering if another solution here is not to go back to the earlier comments about five key principles, but in the process leave it to the individual firms to develop training courses and internal programs around that. If you're going to be a presenter at a board or going to be talking to audit committees, you have to go through this program, and we're going to teach you and train you to what needs to be covered and what are the key elements. The flip side is, how could you do the same thing for audit committee members to bring them up to a higher level of standard? I mean, there are all sorts of licensing requirements if you're in the stock market. Why aren't there licensing requirements if you're on an audit committee? And I know some of that's within your purview and some of it is not.
Right. Some's within and some isn't. Thanks. Thanks, Al. George, sorry, Larry, did you want to respond back to my
question? Yeah, just to that point, because I think I agree. I think Linda said this, that, kind of combining Bob's comment with Linda's, five key principles and maybe some short list of required, absolutely required communications, and the balance of it is other items to consider as they're appropriate in terms of, and that will give the kind of the best practices or memory joggers for auditors that may not be in that top 10%.
Thanks for that clarification. That was helpful. George?
Okay. Thanks, Marty. Speaking from audit committee perspective, I agree with the comments that Denny and Mike make, and then Linda. I like very much the principal's approach to this, because as an audit committee chair, I am most concerned to make sure, is the big question for my fiduciary duty is sort of who audits the auditor. Well, to me, PCAOB should be auditing the auditor. So the most important thing that we can hear at the committee is that, in fact, the auditors are well qualified, well prepared to handle all of what they are supposed to be handling. So that from that perspective, to me, that's the biggest area of interest. Once the PCAOB starts getting onto the agenda of the audit committee, that raises a concern because of our fiduciary duty to make sure that, in fact, we do protect shareholder interest and that we talk at the on the agenda items represent the most important things for the company at that time. And the most important things may not be whether the auditors did what they're supposed to do, but rather, if they say they did it, and financial management represents that, then we want to go to the more important issues such as risks and other kinds of things that the audit committee has to handle. And so my biggest concern is that what happens, and we saw this in 404, is that the agenda started getting crowded over. And everybody has a limited time. There's only 24 hours in the day, no matter what, however you look at it. And so what happens is that an audit committee that goes beyond 2, 3 hours, 4 hours, it gets to the point of not having a good performance in what it does. So my concern is with the check the box, it's going to happen, because I already saw this in one committee meeting that we have a very effective committee, extremely top-notch, and here comes the auditor, and he says, well, I have to communicate. I have to do this. And we're all sort of like you, to the point of getting frustrated, and says, look, we all read the material. You don't have to tell us the accounting policy changes. And we want to move on to more important subject matters. So my concern is that you're putting the auditor in a very difficult situation because, quote, they have to, they should, they're required to do these things. you're putting the audit committee in a difficult situation because they have more important subject matters to discuss. So I would say I like the principal space. And then there's the unintended consequences. To me, with these rules, especially when you when we get to the other subjects, and you're saying that somehow the auditor is going to rate the dual communication, somehow you're giving a little bit more power, if you will, to the in the three-legged stool. You're giving a little bit more say, more power to the outside auditor that maybe is not required, because somehow that outside auditor is now is speaking to certain kinds of things without being requested to. That next thing you know, the management is playing up to them, because if you did put tone of the talk, which I do think is extremely important, but if you put it as a requirement, for example, now you really are distracting everybody to talk about that point. So I worry about the balance, and I think the most important thing that the PCAOB can do to tell the audit committee is to say what I think Harold just said, is the training of the auditors to make sure the auditors are looking for the right things, that they are disclosing, are prepared to disclose. There's nothing to keep them from volunteering, even if not asked, to say, oh, by the way, I think it's important that we mention that in an executive session or the like. So in all the committee, and I sit on three audit committees, in all of them, the subjects that were discussed in this in these requirements actually do come out without being required, because we get asked at one point or other, but it's up to the committee at the right time to bring them up. Having said that, I think the PCAOB did an excellent job of probing these things. As an audit committee member, I really like reading these things. I just don't want them to be requirements, because these have their place.
Thanks, George. Gary Kaberick?
Thank you, Marty. Just give a few thoughts, having listened for the last hour or so here to other people, and share some of the experiences I have with our board. I think one place, perhaps, you know, as you move this process forward, is to actually go to the end of the process. And by the end of the process, I mean, what do a company's audit committee members need to walk out of the room with, sort of knowing or so on. And so in preparation for this meeting, I spoke to some members of our senior management who are on other companies, boards of directors, and is particularly in their audit committee roles. And I would probably paraphrase the feedback I got somewhere along these lines, is that the most important thing they want to walk away from an audit committee meeting with is confidence that there's mutual trust between management and the auditing firm and the audit committee, that they're confident that there's a very open dialogue and that there's a very good, effective working relationship where issues are teed up timely. Everyone has a say at the table, and you work in a collaborative manner to resolve the issue or, if the case may be, to bring it to the audit committee for their decision, as the case may be. But that's sort of what I would probably say is the consensus of what they expect to leave an audit committee with, is that level of confidence that there's a very, very good working process in front of this meeting. So you can ask yourself the question, well, how do you get there? And I think a lot of the people in the room have said that today. It really comes down to the people that are involved in the process, that tone at the top. If there's one thing, I'd probably pick tone at the top. And again, other people here have mentioned it, that the audit committee has to have a feeling that there's a high-quality financial staff, both financial management and internal audit management, in their company, that they're very comfortable with the expertise of the audit the members of the auditing firm assigned to the engagement, that you've got the right mixture of skills and experience and industry knowledge, and that you understand the risks associated with the account, whatever they may be, and that the audit effort is aligned around the risks. So going on, I would probably just say right now that there is a lot of meeting content out there already in audit committee communications, and I think you need to be cognizant that it might not be the best thing in the world to add a lot more to it, and to allow some flexibility for some judgments as to what needs to be brought forward or not. Just one thing in our meeting protocol, and this is true for all of our board committees, is but every meeting has pre-read, and from time to time, all the meeting participants are reminded by the chairs of the committees that you're to approach a meeting content assuming all pre-read has been read and that it's been understood by the members of the committee, and to not spend time just turning the pages, going through it, but focus on the issues that, in this case, the audit committee truly needs to understand, as opposed to just being informed. You can be informed in writing, but spend a limited face-to-face time on understanding the issues. And I'll give an example. Our audit committee has to approve from time to time changes in the annual internal audit plan, and things change. Everyone understands that. But what they do expect to understand is, well, why is it changing? Was it a delay just due to scheduling? Or is it a more permanent problem? Or did higher priority projects emerge? And if so, why are they higher priority, and so on? So I think the ED itself is a well-written document and a really good effort about trying to pull a lot of stuff together that needs to be updated. But I would just sort of close on advising being careful about bulking up on required communications, the expense of deflecting and deflating audit committee focus on the critical issues they need to either understand or to make a decision with.
Thanks very much, Gary. Joan Wagoner.
Thank you, Marty. I just wanted to suggest that perhaps there is a place in principle-based standards for the smaller companies and firms also. And if there is indeed a list of recommendations, that can certainly be used as a sort of a catch-all list for them in there. One of the things that varies widely amongst the smaller companies are all the relationships between these various, legs to the stool. And for instance, in many companies, management and the board are very tight themselves. And so, therefore, the management and the audit committee can have a closer relationship than the audit committee, as they should in some respects anyway, as do the audit committees and the external auditors. And so this creates some odd behaviors, which is sometimes management and the audit committee have this open communication and they talk fairly well, and other times management will only respond to questions. You also can get that same sort of mindset in the audit committee, in the way they talk to the external auditors, where there is not an openness there, and so forth and so on. The other part to this, of course, is the wide range of financial expertise of those participants on the audit committees that you see throughout. It varies widely, so I don't want to overgeneralize here, because there are some audit committees for smaller companies that are truly excellent, and then those others that are more marginal in terms of their participation in the process. As a result, the agenda for the meetings and the communications between the auditors and the audit committees needs to be very flexible to reflect those very different skill sets. There's oftentimes the discussion of the financial statements and the estimates and the policies are perhaps the one or three or four times a year that the audit committee actually does a deeper dive into those particular topics, and they find it helpful. And so I would encourage to allow some flexibility to sort of decide what that agenda should be in the interest of getting those good communications moving forward. Thank you very much.
Alex Mandel.
Thank you, Marty. A lot of really important and good things have been said here. In a way, it's almost difficult to add a lot to that, except maybe to underscore a couple that are at least particularly important from my perspective. The first one in the topic of how we call it the first line of defense, forget now who said it, the role of management in this triangular situation, to me, is a little bit too much on the side. At the end of the day, it is, at least from my point of view, it is management, the financial management that the audit committee depends on to really be assured and understand what the issues are, get all the perspectives of new accounting rules, of judgments, of all the things that are being addressed and being concerned. And to me, the responsibility of the audit committee is to really make sure that that management is up to what it should be. I mean, is covering the right issues, has the right qualifications, is doing a more than adequate job in those areas. And if that is not working right, the audit committee has to address that and do something about it. So I guess if I sort of have a, not a slight, but some additional thoughts on how this three-legged stool should work, I think it's just important to really understand the audit committee's responsibility, making sure, ensuring that financial management can really cover all those points, has the experience, the skill set, the capacity to present and address all those things that need to be addressed. That does not take away in any way from the required communications between the audit committee and the auditor, for sure. But the first starting point, the first element of this dialogue and the flow of information for the audit committee, I think, comes from management. And if that doesn't work, that needs to be addressed. That was one point. I know it's been partially said, I think, by Larry and some others, but I think that is, at least from my point of view, really, really important. The second point that's also been made, and others sort of underscored, but if you sort of step back and say, what should be brought to the audit committee? I mean, the bottom line is things that are really significant or potentially significant make a difference. And there's lots of things proposed that probably are not that significant and might be of interest, might be important, but somebody said, I guess it was George, that, you know, there's a very limited time that the audit committee has available to address issues, to address topics, to address new things, to address ongoing concerns, to address risks, and on and on and on. And therefore, the need and the critical need for prioritizing and really only focusing on those things that really will or could have a significant impact on the financial reports or all the things that go with that, I think would be important. And I think the chairman of a committee has a particular task to make sure that indeed is what happens. Thanks.
Thanks for those comments. I do want to point out, because it's come up a couple of times, and we'll have a further discussion on this in our next topic. The proposed standard clearly does recognize the fact that very important communications are made by management, and in the areas of critical accounting estimates and accounting policies and so on and so forth. And in those areas, the auditor just needs to evaluate whether the management's made the appropriate communications to the audit committee, and then only communicate further if the auditor believes the communications were not sufficient. But I've heard that the point was made a number of times, and we all agree with that, about the importance of management making those communications, and maybe we need to spell that out a little clearer in the standard, because we recognize that point. Thank you. And Turner.
Thanks, Marty. To start off with, I just want to come back to a comment that Mike made about the usefulness of the audit and make it very clear from investors' perspective, we don't think that the usefulness of the audit has been denigrated in the last decade any whatsoever, that in fact the audit's probably more important today than ever, especially given the corporate scandals and the financial crisis. If we can't rely on those financials, and if they aren't credible, then we absolutely are making wrong investment allocations and can't get the returns we need for our investors, and that's critical. So without a doubt, there is no question that the role of auditors and the usefulness of those audited financial statements are probably more important today than ever before. So I don't want to leave a misnomer out there that from an investor's perspective, those have declined at all, Mike. Just a thought. On audit committees, though, I think Hal raised a superb question. There are about 12,000 public companies out there. You get beyond the Wilshire 5,000, and that leaves you with 7,000. It means the vast majority of those probably aren't able to attract the type of talent
that you see in a Mike Cook or a Denny Beresford or a Don Nicolaisen. And in fact, the surveys have consistently shown that that type of expertise, someone who has actually done an audit and understands and knows an audit, are not on those boards. And in fact, that extends not only to those 7,000, but that extends well up into the other 5,000. So not all audit committees are created equal. Not all of them have the knowledge base to ask the right questions. That's not that they're bad people or aren't going to get the job done or whatever. It's just a matter of fact. We just don't have that talent pool out there on the audit committees at this point in time. And in recognition of that, even the Blue Ribbon Committee report suggested, I know it's heresy to some of you, but they actually suggest a checklist of questions for the audit committees right in the report itself, with a list of questions that go beyond what's in the proposal. And in fact, unfortunately, maybe should have been in use, because it gets into a lot of risk assessment questions and high-risk areas, which would have been helpful if some audit committees had been asking those before we ever got into the financial crisis. So the use of a checklist at times is not a necessarily a bad idea, and I think you got to recognize that there is a great diversity amongst the quality and expertise of the people out there trying to do the job. And if we give them some help, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because ultimately what we as investors want to know is that they've done their job. They've asked the right questions. When I go back and look through the proposal, I have to come back and ask everyone around the table, tell me which of those questions that you think the audit committee shouldn't be asking. Tell me which ones you wouldn't ask. I don't think this is a comprehensive, blown-out list. I think it's a very very reasonable starting point. It is a base list. And we've had a principle-based approach to audit committee since 1978, when the New York Stock Exchange came out. And that principle-based approach, quite often, has not worked very well. So creating at least some base floor that will give us as investors some idea that the audit committees are really getting the job done, I think is good. I would love to, in a way, get away from this and just have audit committees tell us in their audit committee report exactly what it is that they have done, and bring transparency and accountability that way, which I think would actually even be a much better approach. Unfortunately, audit committees who can do that today have decided not to do it, and instead give us a very boilerplate report that, quite frankly, doesn't really tell us anything about all these areas that I've just heard need to be discussed. You will almost never, in fact, I might say amongst the 12,000, you won't find an audit committee report that tells us about any of those things that are so critical to us that people just said we need to have them asking. So the information isn't there to hold the audit committee accountable, and I think a lot of the concern around the table is, let's not create something that creates that accountability. I actually think it's an excellent thing, and I think what the PCAOB is doing here is good. There was a question about the federal laws and the role of directors. I think some of the state laws, we've seen the shortcomings, and so I know bothers attorneys tremendously, but we are seeing the federalization of corporate governance here, as the state laws, especially in Delaware, have failed miserably, and as a result we're now seeing say on pay and proxy access, etc. But the courts have ruled that as far as the fiduciary goes in this role, that having a full heart, wanting to do the right thing, but to use the court's word, full heart but empty mind, doesn't work. And in the context of the empty mind, if you haven't asked those questions, the very base questions that the POCOB is putting out here, I don't know how you could respond to the court that you didn't ask those questions. And if you are asking those questions, how can this stifle the conversation? I don't understand it. Back to the issue of the tone at the top. I think there's been some good points raised about it. Certainly no one likes to grade another person and put it down in writing. It's just human behavior. There's something about that you just don't like the feeling of, especially if you're grading the person that's going to be writing you a check. There's just something that makes you nervous about that. But I will also add another point that I think raises the question about how far you want to get into that, even though it's a good question. That is, if we look at the track record of the auditors in actually assessing the tone at the top, they don't have a really good track record. Going back to the mid-1980s, about 85 when we reset the auditing standards, we actually required that the auditors assess, in essence, that is tone at the top. Yet you can look at one situation after another that have popped up where there's been problems, and the auditors thought they were okay with the management team and rode with them and certainly didn't tell the audit committee that this is a disaster, and we had a blow up. So I think it could almost be misleading, given their historical performance and track record, to be sitting there saying, let's have the auditor tell us about the tone at the top, and place too much reliance on that. The track record just doesn't support that approach at all. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. Mary Mars? Is it your card yet?
Thank you, Marty. There's a couple of points I just wanted to make. I appreciate all the comments this morning. I think they're very thoughtful. And I think that as an investor, we feel that audit committees have an opportunity to actually embrace some of these ideas, sort of to articulate their perspectives. And what Lynn was explaining, I think that they can distinguish themselves in throughout the standard in providing that information to investors. There's a couple of key terms that I think that people brought out today that I just wrote down and I thought was really important. You know, good governance, of course, you know, that's really important. The articulation, the transparency, the fiduciary responsibility. So as investors, you know, we look to the audit committee. That's their role to us. That it is so important to us to be able to provide that insight to us. The articulation, I think the SEC has, you know, proxy plumbing, the enhanced disclosure. I think all of that has helped investors. I think one point that, you know, it doesn't relate directly to the standard, but I think audit committees can understand this is, and audit committee members and chairs, the effectiveness of audit committees. I think that question's asked a lot throughout your evaluations, through your perspectives. And I think there was also the point brought up that not all audit committees are equal, and not the experience is not there. And as an investor, I see that when I go out and I speak to audit committees. So I think that the standard would help bring these individuals up, or at least be able to bring that thought process to them. I think that I was looking at, not to throw out names, but Tapestry Networks and E&Y, I think they were talking about the evaluation and the effectiveness of audit committees. And I think the audit committee said to themselves, it's important to not have any surprises, to, you know, of course, have their evaluation, to have that full communication with their auditors, the relationship building. And I think that this is one point I really wanted to stress, was that the standard provides sort of teeth. It really does provide the audit committee the opportunity to sort of distinguish themselves and to say, you know, for investors, you know, this is how you are looking, you're searching for alpha, and you want to invest in our company as a capital provider. So I think it does provide confidence to investors from the audit committee's perspective. And I think that for our search of alpha, there are value. We only have, all of us have limited capital. It's our responsibility to our beneficiaries. But I think this is a way that audit committees can sort of embrace this new standard and distinguish themselves. So thank you.
Thanks. I just wanted to, so many comments have been made regarding tone at the top as being, and the importance of that feature. Some discussion has been made regarding that, how that should be discussed with the audit committee, and I think it's an important point that we'll give some further thought to. But I wanted to bring out the fact that the existing PCAOB auditing standards do require the auditor, as part of the audit, of an organization and their evaluation of the internal controls to assess the tone at the top as part of the control environment in the organization. So auditors are doing that, at least they should be doing that as part of PCAOB standards, and the issue here is now maybe come up a couple of times that some of the members here at the table feel like that's one of the most important things they'd like to hear about is that assessment. Don Nicolaisen.